So to interrupt any conversations, please do grab a seat and we will get underway. Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to Mortgage Talks. Those of you who don't know me, my name is Glenn. I'm part of the staff team over at St. Bottles, and we run these Sunshine Talks and encourage everyone to come along, whether you're curious, whether you're a skeptic, or whether you're a believer. It's great to have Professor Richard Buggs with us here today. He's going to be sharing with us a presentation as we look at the question, can a scientist believe that Jesus did miracles? Professor Richard Buggs is one of the biologists over at Kew Gardens, and he lectures one day a week at Queen Mary as well. Richard can give you a bit more information on that. Just let you know that after Richard does his presentation, there will be an opportunity to ask him some questions if you're able to hang around. And please do make the most of that to, if you have any burning questions whatsoever. And Richard will do his best to answer them. Why don't I invite Richard up here? So, Richard, thank you for joining us. Richard, as I mentioned, you're the biologist at Kew Gardens and Queen Mary is. What is it specifically that you do over there at Kew Gardens?
I lead a research group that looks at the DNA of trees, and we kind of take methods developed for human medicine, like personalized genomics, and we apply them to trees. So, for example, there's a syndrome that's killing lots of oak trees called acute oak decline. And we're trying to understand if there's a genetic component to that. Right. Another thing we work on is ash dieback. We work on Dutch elm disease. Some of the big tree diseases that are devastating our tree populations.
Great. Thank you, Richard. If you want to find out more about that, go onto YouTube, search Richard Buggs, and you can find some of the videos that he's done on that, talking more about that in detail, as I did the other day.
Great.
I really enjoyed it, actually. But I studied biology in Queens, as I told Richard earlier on, so... maybe as well. Richard, what is it that you want to be chatting to us today about?
Well, you've given me the title, Can a Scientist Believe That Jesus Did Miracles? Mm. And I'm going to say yes. You probably guessed that from the fact that I'm here. But I think it's a really important topic, and I think it's great that we're talking about this in a pub with a flying horse. That seems very appropriate to discuss the topic of miracles.
Great stuff, Richard. I'm going to hand over to you and leave it to you. Thank you very much.
Well, thanks, Glenn. If you all don't mind, I might just say a prayer as we begin. Our God and Father, we pray that you will be with us today. Please help me in speaking, and please help everyone as they think through what I say. And please help us to consider this question of whether scientifically we can believe in miracles. And we pray that you would speak to us. In Jesus' name, amen. Well, do grab one of the handouts that is on the table, because that will help you through the talk. And later in the talk, I'll be referring to John's Gospels, and you can find a pile of them on the tables as well. I want to speak in two halves, really. The first half of the talk will be science. A world where miracles can happen, because I think modern science is actually revealing to us evidence that miracles really can happen. And then I will talk about history, a record showing that miracles have happened within recorded human history. So first of all, science, a world where miracles can happen. I spend all of my time at work looking, as I've said, at the DNA of trees and trying to understand how it works and what it does. So my research group is the first group in the world to sequence the genome of the ash tree, and we published that back in 2016 in the journal Nature. And the ash tree genome is 880 million bases long, 880 million letters of DNA long. And we've spent years since then trying to understand in more detail what that is encoding. And it is incredibly sophisticated software. Like every genome, part of it is genes coding for proteins, and then other bits are coding for short RNAs, and all sorts of other things that are governing the expression of the protein-coding genes. And the more we look at genomes, and this isn't just true of trees, this is true of humans and bacteria and everything, the more sophisticated we realise that software is. You know, at one point people thought that it was just the protein coding genes that mattered, and basically everything else is junk. We now realise that actually the stuff that we once thought was junk is actually very sophisticated control mechanisms for controlling gene expression and doing all sorts of other things. So the more we understand, the more complicated and the more amazing it all becomes. And that's not just true of the software that we're finding in the DNA, it's also true of the nanotechnology that we're finding in living cells that is encoded in that DNA. So over the past 30 years, with the method of X-ray crystallography and now more recently with AI algorithms that can predict the structure of a protein, we have discovered all sorts of molecular machines inside living cells. Some of them are motors that turn extremely rapidly and have lots of parts in place that allow rotation to happen. My favourite one is called ATP synthase. There are trillions of ATP synthase molecules in me right now, processing energy to allow me to talk to you. There's also trillions in plants. I was going to gesture to these plants here, but they don't have it because they're plastic. But if they were real, they would be jam-packed with ATP synthase. And basically, a flow of hydrogen ions across a membrane drives rotation of what is essentially a turbine. And as that rotates extremely fast, it has a kind of cam structure that moves the conformation of some molecules above it. And as they move, they take in a little molecule called ADP, and they turn out a molecule called ATP, which has an extra bit added to it. And energy gets moved around the cell in that way. It is the most amazing piece of nanotechnology. And the other thing that I think we appreciate more and more because of the progress of science is the wonder of human consciousness. You know, the fact that our brain, although it is just a physical entity, is somehow hosting a mind that enables us to make choices, to think about life, to philosophize, to appreciate music, to do art, to think in terms of morality and right and wrong. And it's a great mystery to us how this actually works. Sometimes in philosophy it's called the mind-body problem, or the hard problem. And we essentially don't know what's going on with our minds and how it intersects with the brain. And as you know, people have tried to kind of recreate a human brain on a computer and generate artificial intelligence. But the more sophisticated our artificial intelligence becomes, I think the more we appreciate that human intelligence is something above and beyond that. It's not just something computational. There's something there that we really do not understand. And so as science is revealing all of this complexity and wonder to us, and as it's making progress in that direction, we have to think, well, where does all of this come from? Where does all this complexity and sophistication come from? And I've put a quote on the handouts from Professor Brian Cox, who's a very well-known popularizer of science. This is him on the BBC documentary series Universe, which aired in 2021. And he says, everywhere you look on Earth, there is complexity. So you have to ask yourself, how can it be that such complexity can emerge completely naturally in the universe? And that's a very interesting question, isn't it? I think it's a question that everyone asks. But if you look closely at how he's framing that question, he's not just asking how does complexity emerge. He says, how such complexity can emerge completely naturally in the universe? Why does he decide to insert those words, completely naturally? Well, he does so because he is excluding a supernatural explanation, isn't he? He's saying, how can I explain that without reference to the supernatural? How can I explain that without reference to miracles, essentially? So loaded into the way he's asking the question is this caveat that he only wants natural answers. Miracles need not apply as answers to this question. But for me as a Christian, I don't want to limit my question in that way. I'm completely open to the evidence pointing towards a supernatural cause. You know, I believe the supernatural is real. And so I don't want to kind of close my mind to the possibility that science could be pointing me towards the supernatural. But I think really Brian Cox is, and I think many scientists are, particularly the ones who are here on the BBC, they're starting out with a philosophical presupposition that says there is no such thing as the supernatural, miracles cannot happen, therefore I won't even consider the possibility that the evidence could be pointing me towards a miracle. So if we continue reading that quote, we kind of find out how far he gets in his ability to explain this complexity without recourse to a miracle. He says this: "No one knows exactly how life on Earth emerged." Well, that's true. Nobody does know how life on Earth could have emerged without a miracle. It's a huge problem, because modern science has told us that even the simplest life forms are incredibly complex. You know, once upon a time, people thought that if you left a pizza like this hanging around for 2 weeks, the mold that grew on it was life that spontaneously emerged on that pizza. But then in 1859, Louis Pasteur showed, no, that's not true. We have the germ theory now, and that life isn't spontaneously arising. It's because there are spores in the air of the fungus, and they land on there. And it's just the spores growing. Life doesn't just spontaneously emerge. We know that now. And we also know now that for life to function, we need lots of nanotechnology in place, because you have to be able to replicate DNA or RNA in order to have a self-replicating life form. And so this is a really huge problem if we're not willing to admit that a miracle can happen. Because it's absolutely mind-boggling to think that that could happen purely by chance. So many pieces have to be correctly in place before life can actually function, that it's just impossible to believe, to my mind, that could just happen. So Brian Cox continues, okay, he's admitted we don't know how life originated. No one knows exactly how life on Earth emerged, but what we do know is that at some point, primitive cells living in the ocean began using the sun's energy to power life-giving chemical reactions. This process, known as photosynthesis, unleashed the sun's creative power and drove the evolution of complexity from primitive bacteria to plants and trees, and ultimately to you and me. There's a part of that photosynthetic machinery comprised of 46,630 atoms, all working together in an intricate machine. Very efficient, it took billions of years of evolution. Now notice he's not really giving us an explanation there, is he? He's just saying, well, it was evolution. Evolution did it. He's not telling us how evolution did it. He's just saying, well, given a long enough time, evolution can produce complexity. I have a colleague who works on the mechanisms of photosynthesis and has made big contributions towards our scientific understanding of them. And I once, quite recently, said to him, do we have any idea how the photosynthetic apparatus could have evolved? And he just laughed at me and said, we have absolutely no idea whatsoever. Because you see, the problem is, for evolution, for Darwinian evolution to work, you have to have a step-by-step process that is very gradual. It has to happen just by very small changes. Each of those changes has to be small enough to be able to happen purely by chance. And every one of those changes has to lead to an improvement of function. It can't knock out the function of the thing that's changing. It can't even just keep it the same. It has to improve it to be selected on. So the only way you can build up complexity by a Darwinian process is by very small changes, each of which is beneficial. But when we look at these molecular machines that we find in cells, nobody can even imagine such a step-by-step pathway. You know, I've been telling you about a motor called ATP synthase that rotates extremely fast. Well, we know from our everyday life that it's impossible to build up a motor just by step-by-step changes. You have to put parts together, and then you have to put them together with foresight and intelligence before you can get anything to happen at all. The idea that you could gradually build that up by chance events, in a continuous pathway, every step of the pathway having slight improvement of function, is just very clearly not going to work. And you can survey the scientific literature and ask, can anyone give me a step-by-step pathway? Because atheists, of course, would love to have such a pathway. And it turns out nobody can. So we don't know how these complex things could have come about by completely natural processes. If we turn to Richard Dawkins, the well-known atheist, in his book The God Delusion, that was published in 2006, he says this about the origin of biological complexity, and this is the second quote that's there on the handout, writing, Nevertheless, it may be that the origin of life is not the only major gap in the evolutionary story that is bridged by sheer luck, anthropically justified. So he admits, Darwinian evolution cannot tell me how the origin of life happened. As an atheist, my only recourse is sheer luck. For example, my colleague Mark Ridley has suggested that the origin of the eukaryotic cell, our kind of cell with the nucleus and various other complicated features such as mitochondria, which are not present in other bacteria, was an even more momentous, difficult, and statistically improbable step than the origin of life. The origin of consciousness might be another major gap whose bridging was in the same order of improbability. So Richard Dawkins, who's maybe the most famous Darwinian that we have alive today, is essentially saying, I know that there are definitely three gaps in the evolution of complexity which can't be bridged by Darwinian evolution. They're momentous, difficult, and statistically improbable steps. The origin of life, the origin of the eukaryotic cell, the origin of consciousness. Well, to me, that sounds very much like three miracles. Momentous, difficult, and statistically improbable steps. I think that's a miracle, surely. So, Richard Dawkins, of course, would have called them that, but I think it's perfectly rational to say, well, that looks like a miracle to me. I think there must have been at least three miracles in how we got here, and probably a lot more. The origin of life, the origin of the eukaryotic cell, and the origin of consciousness. When we look at the fossil record, we see the fossil record isn't a record of gradual evolutionary change in the main, it's a record of very sudden appearances of complex life forms in diversity, followed by a period of very little change. And then when we look to physics, most physicists today would tell us that the universe started with a Big Bang. Well, what is the Big Bang? If it's not a momentous, difficult, and statistically improbable step. You know, somehow nothing exploded into a world where the physical constants were exactly right for life to be able to form. To my mind, that sounds very much like a miracle. So I think that if we're even-handed with the evidence, if we're willing to consider that miracles might be possible, if we're willing not to constrain ourselves only to explanations which are completely natural, it seems almost obvious to us that science is revealing a series of miracles that were involved in creating the world around us. So as a scientist, I think it's perfectly rational to believe we live in a world that is a consequence of a series of miracles. So that means when I come to something like this, and you'll see on your tables in front of me, John's Gospels. John's Gospel is a biography of Jesus written by John, who was one of his disciples, who lived with him and saw what he did. And then after Jesus had died and rose again, John wrote down an account of his life. And in this book, John records seven miracles that he says he saw Jesus do. The first couple, turning water into wine and healing an ill person at a distance. And then it culminates at the end of the book with Jesus himself rising from the dead. Now, if miracles don't happen, and if John didn't really see miracles, we have to ask ourselves, why would he tell us that he saw Jesus do seven miracles? If he's trying to persuade us to follow Jesus and believe his teaching, why doesn't he just give us a book of the wise teaching of Jesus? Why doesn't he have a book called The Sayings of Jesus and record some of the events of his life and some of how holy and how self-denying he was, and just amaze us with Jesus' holiness and his teaching, and miss out all of the miracles. Because surely that would be just so much more convincing than him making up some miracles. To my mind, the only reason why he would have said Jesus did miracles was if he actually saw him do them and was completely and honestly persuaded in his own mind that miracles had really happened. And certainly for John, we discover, if you turn to page 52, in these John's Gospels, at the top of page 52 you'll see a heading, the purpose of John's Gospel, that's put there by the editors. But then the words after that are written by John himself. Jesus performed many other signs. This is how he refers to his miracles. He calls them signs because he believes they're telling us something. Jesus performed many other signs in the presence of his disciples, which are not recorded in this book. But these are written, these seven that I've written down, that you may believe that Jesus is the Messiah, the Son of God, and that by believing you may have life in his name. So John sees these seven miracles as kind of central to the evidential case that he's making, that Jesus is the person that he thinks he is, that Jesus is the Son of God, and that we should all believe in him. And as I read about these miracles, I find that the way they're presented is very, very persuasive. So, for example, in science, when we want to know if something's true or not, we love to have what's called a blind test, and I'm sure you've all heard of blind tests in the context of testing of drugs. So if someone's produced a new drug against cancer, when they get to do clinical trials, they'll get a cohort of people that all have the same kind of cancer. And then some of them will have the new drug, and some of them won't. They'll have a placebo. And nobody involved in actually administering or taking the drugs will know who has got the actual drug and who has got the placebo. The patients won't know, because if they knew, they might psychologically begin to think, well, I know I've had the real drug, so I'm feeling better. If the people administering it knew, they might subtly treat the data in a slightly biased way. And so the way it's done is nobody knows. Everyone is blind, except the person who gets all the data together. When it's been collected, he says, yep, those ones are the ones that had the real drug. I sometimes do the same thing in my research group. If we're sending off hundreds of samples of DNA to a sequencing centre, I'll say to the PhD student or the postdoc, I am going to pick out some of them myself and do duplicates of them. And I'm not going to tell you which ones are duplicated, but at the end of the whole process, I want you to tell me which were the duplicates in that set of data. And then if they can do that at the end, I know that nobody got anything muddled up when they were labelling the tubes or moving them around. Because I'm the only one who knew which were the duplicates, and if they can tell me the correct answer, then great, I know they've done a good job. In science, we love a blind test. And a blind test is exactly what we find happening in the account of Jesus turning water into wine. So, for example, if you look at page 4 of John's Gospel, chapter 2, you'll see that in verse 7, Jesus tells some servants to fill some big jars with water. And they fill them with water, and then in verse 8 he says, now draw some out and take it to the master of the banquet. They did so, and the master of the banquet tasted the water that had been turned into wine. He did not realize where it had come from, though the servants who had drawn the water knew. Then he called the bridegroom aside and said, everyone brings out the choice wine first, and then the cheaper wine after the guests have had too much to drink. But you have saved the best until now. So the guy who is telling us that this is good wine is a guy who doesn't realise that 5 minutes ago this was water. The servants know that it was water 5 minutes ago, but it's not them telling us it's become wine. It's not some of Jesus' disciples telling us it's become wine. Least of all is it Jesus himself telling us it's become wine. It's someone who is completely unaware of the provenance of this wine, and he's tasting it, and he's saying, this is really good wine. So we have there a blind test. Another thing scientists love is replication. We love to see something replicated. And then if you turn over a couple of pages, page 10, notice that this took place in Cana of Galilee. That's the first line of chapter 2. The wedding took place in Cana of Galilee. And then on page 10, we find ourselves in Galilee again. In verse 46, once more he visited Cana in Galilee, and John helpfully reminds us where he had turned the water into wine. And there was a certain royal official whose son lay ill at Capernaum, which is quite a long way away. When this man heard that Jesus had arrived in Galilee from Judea, he went to him and begged him to come and heal his son. And to cut a long story short, Jesus says to him, okay, I'll heal your son, you can go home. And that happens at 1 o'clock in the afternoon. And then the guy sets off for home, and on the way, it's quite a long journey, on the way his servants meet him, and they're rushing to tell him that his son has got better. And he says to them, what time did he get better? And they say, 1 o'clock. He says, wow, that is the exact time when Jesus said to me he would get better. So he knows the miracle is taking place. But notice, in this case, the servants are blind. They're the ones witnessing that the boy got better, but they're blind to the fact that Jesus said that he should get better at that very moment. And so the guy who puts it all together is their master. So again, we have a blind test of Jesus doing something supernatural. So we have replication and blind test. And as I read through the gospel like this, it reads to me as a very well evidenced and very authentic account of eyewitness testimony of someone actually witnessing miracles. Miracles that they were not at all expecting to see. Miracles that amazed them and shocked them. When we get to the raising of Lazarus, we find that nobody thinks that Jesus can possibly raise this guy from the dead. And then they're shocked when he actually does. You know, these are not primitive people who are just silly and superstitious. These are people just like us who know that miracles don't happen normally. But we read how they were persuaded that they did. So to my mind, the evidence is very compelling that Jesus really did do miracles. Of course, someone like Richard Dawkins would say, well, John originally did, and Richard Dawkins says this in the God Delusion. He said, John initially didn't write anything about miracles in his gospel. It was just an account of Jesus' life and teaching. And then centuries and centuries later, the miracles got added in, when we were so far from the event that nobody could ask an eyewitness and actually disprove that they happened. But modern archaeology has discovered more and more fragments of John's gospel that go right back to the 2nd century AD. So the time just simply isn't available for the evolution of John's gospel in the way an atheist like Richard Dawkins would suggest. And I've just got a diagram here showing approximately when some of these discoveries date back to. So that attempt by an atheist to kind of get away from the truth of John's gospel, I think, is actually very flawed. So to my mind, it is very rational, from the evidence of modern science and as a scientist, to believe, number one, that we live in a world that got here through a series of creative miracles. And that as we read an account like John's gospel, that we read an authentic account of miracles actually happening in the real world. So as a scientist, I believe miracles can happen, and that Jesus really did do miracles. Well, what does that mean for us today? I think it makes a huge difference to us. I think it changes the way we view the world. If previously we viewed it as somewhere where miracles don't happen, and where we just don't need to recourse to miracles as an explanation for everything. And John clearly wants his accounts of miracles to have an effect on us. You know, I read earlier what he said on page 52. Jesus performed many other signs in the presence of his disciples, which are not recorded in this book. But these are written that you may believe that Jesus is the Messiah, the Son of God. He says this is revealing to us that Jesus is divine, and that by believing you may have life in his name. So he thinks that if we believe in Jesus, that will make a difference to us. We will have life in his name. And if you read John's Gospel, you read an account where he meets a guy called Nicodemus. And Jesus says to Nicodemus, you must be born again. You must have completely new life. You need a fresh start. You need God to do a miracle in you to give you new spiritual life. And that is a miracle that Jesus is still doing today. So if you believe in Jesus, you might not see a miracle like him turning water into wine or him healing someone at a distance or raising someone from the dead, but there is a miracle that you will experience, and that is Jesus will give you new life. He'll give you new spiritual life and a new beginning. He enables you to turn your back on the sins of the past and the bad habits that you want to give up. He can release you from the guilt and the sorrow and all of the things that are weighing you down. He can give you a fresh start. He can give you new life. And it's life not just now in terms of a spiritual renewal, but it's life that will go on eternally. It's life that will last forever. And that's the miracle that Jesus is still doing today. And we can have that miracle happen in us if we ask him to do that. When I was a teenager, I did that. I asked Jesus to give me new birth, to give me new life. And it didn't happen straight away, but eventually it did. And the simple habits that I wanted to be able to break up, I was able to break up after that. The relationship with God that I wanted to have, I was able to have after that. And I believe that was a miracle. I don't know, that's not something I could have done for myself. And that's a miracle that all of us can have happen if we believe in Jesus and ask him to do it. So I'd really encourage you, if you haven't before, do take your John's Gospel home with you. Do read it. Do read the account of Jesus' life, his teaching, his miracles. And do pray to him that he would give you new birth, that he would work a miracle in you and give you eternal life. Thank you.
Yes, Allah.
So the blind test and the replication thing. I mean, these are accounts, these are texts that claim that these blind tests and replications happen. Is there any way to actually have a blind test and replication right now in an epistemically rigorous setting?
What do you mean?
Well, I mean just to examine a miracle in some kind of experimentally rigorous setting, pre-registration and double blind. Double binding of all participants and so on. But for example, that famous candy goat of Brown, I don't know if you saw that one in Mozambique, apparently, where it was suggested that she could actually just do this without informing the people who are allegedly being prayed for to have a better eyesight and hearing. She said that, well, no, God needs us to hug them and inform them that they're being prayed for, and we can't do that. Something like that, where you actually have these measures in place to prevent any confounding factors from getting in actual miracles now.
Well, I don't think we need that, because I think the account we have in John's Gospel and in the rest of the Bible is well evidenced and persuasive. I don't think it would help the case if I could turn that jug of water into wine right now. And besides, I'm not claiming to be divine anyway, so why would I be able to do it? I mean, if Jesus himself were here in person, I'm sure he could do it. But if I could do it, it would be less special him doing it. I mean, if any Tom, Dick or Harry could turn water into wine, then it wouldn't be such a special thing. So in some ways, it would undermine my case if I could turn water into wine.
Why would Jesus have to be here in person? What does that mean exactly?
Well, the whole point of why Jesus did miracles was to show that he is the Son of God. And so that only works if miracles happen when he is present. And it's clearly him doing them.
Is he not always present everywhere?
Yeah, he is. He is. As God, he is. But if water was being turned into wine sort of all over the place all the time, it would cease to be a sign that he, in particular, was the Son of God, wouldn't it?
Well, I expect only when you specifically, you know, pray for it to happen as a demonstration of, as a demonstration of miracles to an unbeliever, for example. That would be, you know, an interesting demonstration of something like that.
So you would have to be saying to God, well, I don't believe this account here, okay? I don't believe this is genuine. I don't believe this is true. I don't believe the teaching. Please, can you do something extra for me? Because otherwise I won't believe it. I think that's kind of playing games with God. I think we have to look at what He's given to us. You know, He's given us a well-evidenced, persuasive account, and given us a free offer of eternal life. And I think for us to say, well, I need my own personal miracle is probably not the response he's looking for. Yeah. Any other questions? Yeah, Brian.
Right, yeah. Richard, you mentioned in terms of evolution that the fossil record shows that it didn't happen in nice, smooth, tiny little steps. I mean, it's a massive subject. I just wonder whether you could quote one or two sort of dated, simple examples of where there's a gap, where we can't explain how we got from one to the next.
Yeah, well, essentially, each different life form just suddenly appears in the fossil record. So you have, for example, the Cambrian explosion, where a whole load of new life forms emerge. With plants, you very suddenly get a group called gymnosperms, which are plants that have seeds but not flowers. And then much higher up in the fossil record, you suddenly get the flowering plants appearing in the mid-Cretaceous. And I've looked at it a lot more closely for plants than for other forms of life, but I understand that this is pervasive throughout the whole of the fossil record, that it is these just sudden appearances of new life forms in complexity. And then you get slight changes and some diversification happening, but not other new life forms until suddenly another burst happens. Yeah.
Right, so that burst of complexity, as it were, it isn't consistent with what we know as evolution.
With gradual change, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, thank you.
This burst, I think we had this kind of conversation a little bit last time as well. Like, this burst of complexity doesn't come out of nowhere, right? There are trees existing before gymnosperms, and there are primates existing before humans, and hominins existing before humans, and it just...
Yeah, but then you get this step. You get this big step up. You know, suddenly there's something new on the scene. And what we don't see is a whole load of intermediate forms between what was there before and what's there now. In the case of, for example, gymnosperms and angiosperms, you just suddenly get angiosperms, the flowering plants, appear.
All right, but let's take the case of humans, right? I mean, we have all these different hominid species that look increasingly more like Homo sapiens, and some even exist in parallel with Homo sapiens, like Neanderthals, for example. If God just created all of this from scratch, then He doesn't need to only be able to create humans just at the point when non-human hominids get increasingly human-like.
Yeah.
Just create them at that point, out of nowhere.
Yeah. I'd say two things to that. One is, I think the description you're giving of the fossil record is a big oversimplification, and it's not just a gradual sort of progression from chimpanzees to humans. People used to think that, but modern findings show that actually it's far more complicated than that. And you get mixtures of different features that are not in a sort of gradual evolutionary pathway in the way that you've described. That's one thing I'd say about the physical forms. The other thing I'd say is, even if the physical forms did show some sort of gradual progression, we know that there's a qualitative difference between us and chimpanzees in the terms of our consciousness, in terms of our minds. You know, that our ability to think is so much greater than theirs, and the kind of things we think about so much greater than theirs as well. And the massive problem is, where does that come from? Evolution is just about surviving and reproducing. Well, chimpanzees survive and reproduce just fine. So why do we have these higher cognitive abilities? Why do we have a sense of right and wrong? You know, why are we willing to do altruistic things? A lot of the extra abilities we have actually, in some cases, impede us from surviving and reproducing. And so that's a real problem from an evolutionary point of view. How do you explain how this evolved when there's not really a pressure for it to evolve coming from survival and reproduction? So there's something unique there about humans that is intrinsically incredibly difficult to explain in evolutionary terms.